This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined live and in person by Brian Palmer Rubin, a colleague of mine at Marquette University, who is the author of Evading the Patronage Trap, Interest Representation in Mexico, which was published by the University of Michigan Press in 2022, I believe. And I'd like to welcome Brian to the podcast and ask him to tell us a little bit about himself and how he came to this project, which is really fascinating in understanding what's going on, not only in Mexico, but also in Latin America in a more contemporary time, thinking about economics and politics and how they operate together or in opposition to one another. Hello, Brian.
Hi, Lily. I'm really excited to be here and happy to be talking about this book, which is finally in this last year seeing the light of day. A little bit about the genesis of the project. This is one of those books that was a doctoral dissertation. So this was my dissertation at UC Berkeley. But there's a long story that comes before it being my dissertation. I spent going all the way back to my undergraduate time, the very early 2000s. I've always been interested in organizations, in particular how marginalized populations, or what we can think of as non-elite economic actors, organize to influence policy. This has led me to study a wide variety of different sorts of organizations. When I began, I was interested in sort of ethnic minority groups or marginalized ethnic groups. As an undergraduate, I worked on ethnic groups in Africa. I wrote my undergraduate thesis on the Uganda autonomy movement in Uganda. And then lived for a couple of years in Bolivia and studied indigenous movement in Bolivia, went to Mexico and sort of continued to study indigenous politics in Latin America. And when I got to UC Berkeley, I found a crowd of graduate students and faculty that was also really interested in thinking about these sorts of organizations, not organizations representing non-elite actors. And I just sort of made the switch where now I was focusing on actors representing economic groups. In the case of this dissertation, small business owners and farmers. And the book focuses specifically on the case of Mexico, but I worked to construct, to put together an argument that I think applies more broadly to middle-income democracies.
Yeah, and you also obviously are fluent in Spanish. I've heard you speak with your children and your family in Spanish. And so that clearly was an asset in doing field research, because you did also spend a lot of time in Mexico for the work in the book, as you also talk about in the acknowledgments. But what you're looking at here, as I sort of am teasing it apart, is that, as you say, that there are economic groups that have been successful in sort of having policies that work for them. And there are other groups, other economic groups, that have been less successful in having state policies or regional policies that work for them. Can you talk a little bit about the farmers, the small business groups, the political parties, and how these things all come together in the sort of overarching framework?
Absolutely, yeah. So I love your summary, because I think what you just described helps me do this bridge, do this sort of framing that I try to do, where I'm to some degree bridging my work to classic literature on what sort of scholars of American politics have called biased pluralism, right? So anyone who's read Dahl's Who Governs or classic work by Lindblom and others is sort of familiar with this idea that the interest arena in the United States, or interest, the sort of spectrum of interest groups, tends to overrepresent elite economic interests in economic policy when compared with non-elite economic interests, right? Classically, we think of business versus labor, but we can expand that to include groups like, you know, large agribusiness and small-scale farmers, transnational business and domestic small business, right? You can add lots of qualifiers to that. So the Latin American story is sort of interesting. Most Latin American countries, and Mexico was sort of an exemplary case of this, in the mid-20th century period, had systems of interest representation, or sort of ways of representing economic interests, which could be described as corporatists. The C word for those of us who study Latin America and Western Europe. And these corporatist arrangements were based on really strong, stable, sort of mass-based working class parties.
You are explaining about corporatist arrangements in Latin America in the mid-20th century.
That's right. Yeah. So many countries, and the biggest, sort of most famous examples of this form of corporatism were Argentina under the Peronist Party, Mexico under the PRI, also Venezuela and Peru had really prominent labor-based corporatist parties. And these are political parties that form long-standing, intimate relationships with peak-level organizations of labor, right? These are in some cases sort of modeled on what we saw in lots of Western European countries like Germany, Sweden, France. There's a lot of work in the middle and late 20th century on the texture of these corporatist relationships, what sorts of representation was offered to workers, in what ways were workers controlled by these political parties through these often coercive relationships. And then sort of by the end of the 20th century, you know, research on economic policy and organized interests in Latin America focuses on kind of the decline of corporatism, the death of corporatism through neoliberal economic reforms. We see that every country in the region coming out of what had had military dictatorships adopt these liberal economic models where the state withdraws from all sorts of regulation of the economy, subsidizing lots of different sorts of economic activity, sells off state-owned enterprises, reduces the size of the welfare state, liberalizes macroeconomic policy, enters into free trade agreements, right? And the idea is now we're in a system where the market determines how the economy is going to be run, and not the state.
And so this is what you talk about in the book as the transition period. So this happens as sort of as the conclusion of the 1980s. The United States is also in a big deregulatory sort of zone. And so you have the move from corporatist arrangements in a lot of these Latin American countries that had been pretty strong and solid to this sort of evolution to more neoliberal, less nationalized, more deregulated situation. And you have two case studies that you're looking at in the sort of latter half of the book with regard to a lot of different kinds of data, that you have small farmers, not big agribusiness, but small farmers in rural areas, and then small businesses, not big corporations, but small businesses, and how they differently operated within the new sort of neoliberal economic climate, but also a changed kind of political climate. Can you talk about that political climate?
Absolutely. Yeah. And you're getting that's exactly right. And I think, you know, there had been a lot of important work that was done in Latin America, a lot of research. And in Mexico in particular, people like Marcus Kurtz, Richard Snyder, Ken Green, lots of books who study the transition itself. This became an area of a really big, important interest. And these works were really influential on my own. Ken Jablin studied organized business as well. A lot of these people were sort of graduates of UC Berkeley as well, not coincidentally. But what I sort of noticed what we were missing, or what this book tries to do, is say, okay, what came next, right? I don't study the transition. I study the system of interest representation after the transition, right? This transition was over 20 years ago. And when I talk about the transition, there's two pieces to it. One is the neoliberal transition, which we've been referring to, this transition in the way economics operates. And the other is a political transition. In the Mexican case, this is a really clear move from what had been a one-party dominant system, a political system that was dominated by a single political party, the PRI, which came into power after the Mexican Revolution and won every single election at every level of government for 60 to 70 years, depending on how you date the exact beginning and the end of the PRI's regime. And at the end of this period, you sort of see the birth of this relatively stable three-party competitive system in Mexico. Sort of neat. The PRI remains alive as a sort of centrist actor, which persists as sort of a diminished version of itself. The PAN challenges the PRI as the center-right, sort of pro-business, classically linked to the Catholic Church. This is the party, the PAN, had been founded in the 1930s, but really it ends up being a revived version of it, ends up being the party that displaces the PRI finally for the presidency in 2000. And you have the DRD, the left-wing political party, counted in 1989, which challenges the PRI both on the state level and in federal elections, trying to, they're posing an economic model to calling back to the period prior to the neoliberal reform.
And so this change in not only the economic sort of operation in Mexico, but also more broadly speaking in Latin America, and then this change in the party system and thus politics leads to, as you say, sort of different organizational capacities that are in some cases to the asset of people in the economy, in some places are detrimental to people in the economy. And I'd love for you to start getting into some of these asymmetries, because this is also part of what you talk about in terms of where the rural farmers ended up.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. So I see. So there's sort of two pieces to this. One is what happens to organizations? How do organizations exist and operate in this new post-transition period that I'm analyzing, right, which you can sort of date as the period post 2000 or so. And then what does it mean for the interests of these particular economic actors that I care about? Starting with the organizations themselves, right? So corporatism, the sort of the mid-20th century system that had been characteristic of these dominant parties, was often described as having inducements and the constraints. This is how an important article that my doctoral advisors, David and Ruth Collier, wrote, was titled "This Inducements and Constraints." And the idea was political parties or states offered lots of stuff to labor unions that were embedded in corporatist relationships. In particular, most importantly in corporatism, these political parties or the state helped solve the collective action problem, often by requiring mandatory membership. Right. Labor unions at the union shop, there was something that the state allowed or enforced. And this is what keeps labor unions alive. They can charge dues on all of these people that have to belong to the labor union. In addition to this, right, the state would offer lots of sort of nominations for public office to labor leaders. They would be given sort of positions in important bureaucratic or ministerial posts, and have a say over policy through the formal or informal channels, or sort of the idea behind corporatism. And in Mexican case, like in lots of other cases, there was sort of a similar parallel structure for organizations of business. There were business chambers that also enforced mandatory membership. Business owners or representatives of these business chambers played an important role in setting economic policy as well. Always subject, however, to sort of constraints from the state. You know, we have to keep in mind these are states, sort of semi or fully authoritarian systems, And so when they think that these sort of aligned interests are getting out of line, right, if they try to take to the streets in protest, or if they threaten to support an opposition party, there are some repressive and sometimes violent things that the state could do to crack down on that, right? So that was the story of the last century, not to dwell too long on the last century. Today, right, under the sort of pluralist system, the not corporatist system, but the pluralist system, both the inducements and the constraints are less. They're both relaxed quite a lot, right? So the state offers a lot less in terms of subsidy, in terms of regulation to help keep organizations afloat, but it also restrains them a lot less, right? And organizations are a lot more free to align with different political parties, choose the ways in which they seek to make demands, right? They can engage in protest, they can make noise in the media, they can lobby politicians of different political parties, they can hold campaign events. You see sort of a proliferation of different sorts of actors, which previously had been considered outsiders of these corporatist relationships: indigenous actors, extremely poor landless peasants, informal sector workers, neighborhood associations, particularly in poor urban slums. We see it in an interest arena, or sort of an arena of organizations that's much more pluralistic, has lots of different sorts of interests who are now sort of allowed to make demands, but it's not so clear that they are able to make demands, right? So they still face this really trenchant challenge of sustaining whatever for Jewish organizational capacity, which is sort of finding a way to sustain a large and active.
And so one of the points that you are making that you also just were talking about in the title of your book is interest representation. And this is essentially what you've been talking about, is you have more fluid opportunity as an indigenous person in Mexico, or as somebody who is growing a unique crop, as opposed to sort of your basic corporate business type who usually has access because they have more money and more connections. But what you're saying is that the sort of interest representation only goes so far, it seems, because of some of the fragments or leftovers from the corporatist period. And you talk about this a priori sort of situation for one group that's intact, but not so much with the other group that's intact, I think. Can you explain a little bit about what this kind of idea of interest representation is, and how there is more or less success?
Sure. So interest representation, it's a kind of a wonky sounding term, but it's what we can think of it as the process of translating interests into demands, right? So all sorts of people come to politics with different sorts of interests. In the case of my book, I'm really thinking about economic interests, right? So farmers, to get really concrete, if you're a small scale corn farmer who has just a few acres of land, what are your interests, right? You would like stable and high prices for corn. You would like someone who drives by your farm to buy your corn. You would like an irrigation system so you can water your corn and not suffer droughts. You would like sort of subsidies from the government, crop insurance. Basically, you want a stable and profitable industry for the thing that you're doing.
Right.
And an organization, if an organization forms to represent small-scale corn farmers, they sort of encounter these farmers with all of these interests, and they decide, A, which of these interests are we going to prioritize, and B, how are we going to pursue? And that is interest representation, right? It's the process of an organization making those decisions and sort of engaging with the state, engaging in participation in that way. What I diagnose in looking both at the small-scale agricultural sector and the small business sector is that is this big difference between, I end up sort of differentiating between two main models of interest representation. One is the programmatic model, and the other is the patronage model. The programmatic model of interest representation is the model in which these organizations are making demands on behalf of their sector, right? So this would be an organization of corn farmers, right? Maybe a local organization, but oftentimes embedded in a much larger confederation of grain farmers or corn farmers that extends across Mexico. And they're pushing for policies that are going to stand to benefit small-scale corn farmers, right? And these are things like, let's get the state government or the federal government to introduce price supports. So across Mexico, corn never gets below X pesos per ton, right? Let's get the government to crack down or to renegotiate NAFTA to keep the U.S. from dumping extremely cheap corn in Mexico. Let's get the government to invest across lots of territory and irrigation systems, which are going to make it easier and more profitable for people to grow corn. These are sort of examples of the kinds of demands that I would classify as programmatic. It's an organization kind of engaging in these policy-making processes to make things better for people who belong to an economic sector. This is the sort of programmatic demand making is what we think of when we think of kind of interest group lobbying in the United States, I think.
That's what I was going to say. Sounds like lobbyists to me.
we often think of it as being sort of a corrupt or representing sort of favoritism, right? We think, oh, the Iowa corn farmers are there trying to get the U.S. government to subsidize ethanol. For me, this programmatic lobbying, it's not necessarily the case that these demands are always good in the sense that, like, sort of the aggregate level, like these demands are pursued, right, with policy,
right,
that everyone's going to be better off, or this is what the government should do. These are like these programmatic demands should be part of a debate, which leads to some policy outcome that balances the interests of lots of different actors. But what I'm going to argue is this programmatic demand making it much better than the alternative, which is the patronage version of representation. The patronage model of representation is where organizations engage with a much narrower form of demand making. What they're trying to do is they're really specifically trying to extract as much of these sort of discretionarily allocated programs from the government. The organization leader gives directly to members. In this way, it's quite close. Or when organizations are engaging in this patronage representation, they are sort of converting into clientelistic machines, right? So a lot of work on Latin American politics looks at clientelism. His book sort of butts up against this literature on clientelism, where I'm sort of saying, look, sometimes clientelism isn't just a party boss buying off the votes of individual voters. Oftentimes there's an organization which was like founded decades or years ago to do some totally different thing, right? To represent small-scale corn farmers, agricultural policy. And oftentimes that organization gets sort of wrapped up in this politics of negotiating with politicians for them to sort of deviate in an often illegal or informal way government benefits to the organization leader who gives them to members to mobilize these members in campaign events or to give them to vote in a certain way.
So clientelism in sort of Latin America or specifically in Mexico in this form is often like the old style political machines in the United States in terms of like, how do you get your folks satisfied, but also make use of them for your political ends? And you talk about the fact that the patronage sort of model is one that also has deeper roots in Mexico and Latin America more generally. As you say, it's sort of been categorized as clientelism. But in this sort of post-transition time in Mexico, where does it sit with regard to the more economically deregulated state and the more sort of politically deregulated state with more party flourishing?
Yeah, it's a great question. What has happened to clientelism through all of these economic and political transitions that I've been talking about? So during a previous period in Mexico, clientelism was a huge piece of how the dominant party kept itself afloat. There would be a lot of sort of in the lead up to elections, distribution of largesse from the state, all different politicians kind of would view state coffers as their campaign ways to buy out voters, sometimes individually, right? Here's $10, you know, make sure when you go to the ballot, you vote for us. And there would be this, you know, scholars have depicted, journalists have depicted these really interesting variety of ways that politicians make sure that voters are following through on the clientelist bargain, right? They would send small children into the ballot box to look at the ballots and make sure. They would ask people to, either they have cell phones, they ask people to take a picture of their ballot. The politicians or the brokers on the ground would give people a ballot that was already filled out and ask them to submit that ballot and then return the unfilled up. There have been these decades long sort of machinery or technology of vote buying and monitoring of the way people follow through on clientelistic bargains. So my argument is that clientelism becomes even more important in the post-transition period, in part because the sorts of corporatist sectoral supports are no longer around, right? So before, if the PRI could get it's sort of party-affiliated labor unions on its side through all sorts of policies that were just good for workers, right? Labor policy, you're going to increase your wages, right? Today, if the state's not engaged in wage bargaining, but they still have the sort of party-linked labor union or these sort of party-linked peasant associations, they say, well, we can at least use them to do this much kind of smaller, more piecemeal clientelist sort of bargain, right? So what piece of it is with the decline of corporatism, I think clientelism becomes more central. The other piece of it is now you get electoral competition, right? It goes from being a one-party system to this multi-party system where politicians arguably have more incentive to buy lots of votes because they're starting to stave off challenges from opposition.
And so in this situation where you have these two models, and you talk about the fact in the book that the agriculture sector is one that is more in the patronage zone, and that the small businesses have actually really kind of flourished in this programmatic model, which makes some sense. In terms of the kinds of demands that small businesses might be making and the fact that the rural agriculture sector may be less organized in particular ways. But at the same time, we sort of have this situation where the new on the ground Mexican reality is one that now has both of these models at work. So what do we do about that? Or what do we do about it? Don't want to be imperial here. What is Mexico doing?
So things are keying up the basic asymmetry. And yes, the idea is, right, the reason we get sort of unequal political representation, the reason lower class actors tend to be underrepresented in economic policy, I'm going to argue, is because the organizations that would be voicing their interests, that would be out there making demands on behalf of the poorest farmers or the urban squatters or the informal sector, to the street vendors, those sorts of organizations are often caught up in this patronage politics, right? And it's easier in lots of ways for organizations that represent middle class or even upper class actors. It's easier for them to sustain collective action, to sustain their organizational capacity without having to turn to the sort of Faustian patronage bargain. So we have these two. One more thing I should say, though, is importantly, it's easier for the middle class sort of chamber of commerce to sustain active without patronage than it is for the small scale sort of peasant organizations to do so. But that's not fully determinative, right? Even an organization representing the poorest of economic actors can evade this patronage trap, as I referred to it, if they find some way to sustain collective action autonomously. This is really important for me, right? Because we don't want to say, well, we should just leave poor people now out of policy taking altogether, because the only thing they ever look for is handouts from the government. That's the last thing I would want people to take from my book, right? But the question is, the point is there's this asymmetry which introduces really important challenges for the representation of non-elite or sort of marginalized economic interests. And what can we do sort of cheat them out of this patronage form of politics and instead should support a more programmatic form of representation for these actors whose interests tend to be ignored.
And you do have an exception to what, I don't want to say it's the rule, but what you found in your research, that the small rural poor individuals or economic and interests mostly are in this patronage system, but you have an exception where that's not the case. Can you talk about that particular example?
Yeah, so this is one sort of noble case of the book, which stands out as my success case. It's a confederation of organizations called ANEC, Asociación Nacional de Empresas Comercializadoras de Productos de Productores del Campo, right? So it's association, the National Association of Commercializing Agricultural Producers in Mexico. You should, one of the things that I think my, whatever my book is good for, I think I probably hold the record for the longest list of acronyms of any book that you've ever.
It was very impressive. I was like, wow, okay, let's move on from then.
The first couple pages of the book. Creating an index was quite a challenge given all those acronyms, long-named organizations. So this organization had a really, so they're founded in the early 1990s, and they offered, and they were founded this model of operating agricultural cooperatives. So their idea was, we see that NAFTA's coming, right? We see that Mexico is on its way to entering into much more liberal or globalized agricultural markets. And this is going to make it really hard for small-scale corn farmers to compete. Right? We know that corn prices are going to go down. We know that the way in which you had previously sold your corn wasn't going to be available anymore, right? And it used to be that there would be these state-operated kind of silos that would buy corn, that would send trucks all around the countryside and buy corn from people, so often at subsidized pricing. That whole system was being torn down as part of NAFTA. NAFTA comes into effect in 1994. And corn farmers are going to sort of be thrown to the wild, right, to feed on their own. And the next says, let's set up a model. We'll sort of create a network of local cooperatives that are setting up a model to make it so the corn farmers can be somewhat more profitable so that they could keep growing corn in this new liberalized agricultural market. So they operate these cooperatives, right, where corn farmers bring together their products in a big, you know, sort of storage facility, and a representative of the cooperative then sells it at a larger scale. When you have more corn to sell, you can attract a better buyer. You can get higher prices. They were also able to sort through the joint economic activity of all the members of these local cooperatives, right? A typical cooperative would have a couple hundred farmers or so, right? If they pool together all of their economic activity, they can get a loan from the bank, which allows all the different farmers to invest in their farms, build the irrigation system, diversify beyond growing corn. A NEC, the organization, would bring in trainers to teach farmers how to use new technologies, new sorts of machinery, new sorts of inputs to increase their crop yields. So point is, a NEC sets up a model where they're offering these really valuable services, these really valuable productive services that give people a reason to want to participate. Corn farmers join because they see, you know, they see their neighbors who have joined the cooperative, and they say, heck, they're growing 10 tons per hectare. I'm only growing 5 tons of corn per hectare. I'd like to learn how I can grow 10. And it looks like if I joined the cooperative, I could do that. Right? And so this is what I refer to as sort of more as an internally generated organizational capacity model. It's sort of a mouthful, but all it means is that the organization itself is offering these services that give people a reason to join and to participate. And therefore, the organization, it doesn't rely on this patronage politics as a way to give members a reason to participate.
But there's only one example of this. And has it been examined, and have other groups or areas, regions explored taking on a similar kind of cooperative approach, particularly in the sort of agriculture system?
There are there's quite a lot of cooperatives in Mexico of this type, right? Sometimes they don't last forever, right? It can be difficult to keep people together. This is sort of a messy politics. In this way, I'm really inspired by Eleanor Ostrom, who talked to, writes about co-production, right? And she says this is sort of what they're kind of doing, right? That they're it's kind of a grassroots bottom-up solution. How do we work together to set up a system that's going to work for all of us, and also where and when appropriate to engage with the state, so the state can provide certain resources that help this model work and help this cooperative model work. And importantly, evading any sort of dependence on state actors, right, is really important for NDEC, for organizations like this to make sure that they don't enter into relationships of dependence, where the state's going to start calling for shots and try to mobilize these farmers for their own electoral purposes. But anyway, one of the things that Ostrom says is, right, that this is messy. Co-production is messy. It doesn't always, there are sort of moments where it works really well and it solves certain problems, and then these these organizations kind of dissipate, right? And we just certainly need to be aware of that. ANEC, what's sort of important about ANEC is this national network of these cooperatives. So there's lots of experiments throughout the territory of Mexico, small-scale farmers trying to join together and offering these sorts of services, offering a cooperative and these training programs. And the net and ANEC is sort of the headquarters of Mexico City that helps knit together a network, offer some sort of advice and support for these local cooperatives.
So ANEC, in a certain sense, is a better lobbying model that's not necessarily falling into the patronage trap, but isn't necessarily a chamber of commerce kind of model for Mexico.
So I'm talking up until now is a lot of what ANEC does, or these sort of ANEC affiliates, the cooperatives that are affiliated with this network, what they do for their members. But the argument, the book, right, when we get to this question of interest representation, is that now that you have these members who are sort of in the fold because we're offering these really useful services, now the organization, the leadership can turn, when it turns to the state, it can turn and start asking, representing small-scale grain farmers in a more programmatic way, right? Asking for these sorts of demands, the same to benefit the whole sector. Because they're not stuck in this dependent relationship where they're just trying to get more of these subsidies, these social programs, more of these sort of one-off government benefits that would be used in a clientelistic way. To bring it to the small business sector, I actually what constantly surprised me is how the extent to which ANEC and these sort of agricultural cooperatives were modeled after small business organizing. In Mexico, business chambers. So I look at the book of three major confederations of business organizations. There's the Confederation of Chambers of Commerce, the Confederation of Chambers of Industry, right, small industrial firms, and another relation which is called Coparmex, which is sort of another small business advocacy organization. These are all organizations that are representing small and medium-sized businesses. So we're not talking about the Business Roundtable. We're not talking about Carlos Slim. And we're talking about firms, most of which have fewer than 10 employees, right? And these chambers are similar. They have a membership, which is often in the hundreds, sometimes in the thousands. It's a bunch of small business owners who have really specific interests. They would like to see better roads, better parking, better security outside their business establishment. Sometimes they would like to see the local government, like the city government, keep a Walmart from moving in because the Walmart's gonna take a lot of clients away from them. They would like to see crackdowns on informal commerce or on piracy, the other sorts of things that they see as threats to their activity. And these organizations would often describe, these sort of chambers of commerce or other sorts of business chambers, would describe their political activity as being sumamente político, pero apartidista, which means completely political but nonpartisan.
Okay.
They do, in Mexico, right, if once you link up with a party, once you become sort of closely aligned with the party, there's this big suspicion that you are going down this patronage path. You are sort of, what you're probably doing is promoting the electoral prospects of the organization leader who wants to run for mayor herself, and you're trying to funnel more money from the state to give to your members in this kind of corrupt, corrupt, unfair way, right? Where you're prioritizing your members over the sector. And these chambers are working really hard to say, no, this is not what we're doing. What we're doing instead is we're acting on behalf of the sector. The way we do that is we don't link up with any political party, we don't engage in this patronage politics. We're going to be an actor that's pushing for these policies that are going to benefit small business owners.
Right. So it's policy demands, not necessarily partisan demands. So in the United States, we would sort of look at that and say, hey, that's deregulation, or that's, road construction, as you mentioned, but not culture war issues. And so you're not sort of going into a partisan zone in that regard. And so what you've sketched out of the book is a kind of snapshot of what's kind of going on now in the post-transition period. But you're not necessarily sort of saying this is what's going to happen in perpetuity. And is this also a kind of model for other Latin American countries, or is Mexico or and some of this sort of fluidity in terms of how politics is operating with economics, is this the result of other models in Latin America that Mexico has been looking at?
So beyond Mexico, there's two sides to this story. The first part, which we've been talking about mostly, is the organizational side. And I make a case, particularly in the conclusion of the book, that the organizational story, the story about how organizations generate organizational capacity, this is something that is not specific to Mexico. This is a story that at least operates in other regions of Latin America and other middle-income democracies like, you know, Brazil and India. And I think we find really similar echoes in organizations in the United States and in wealthy democracies as well. What do I mean by that? My book is sort of a call to look at the way that organizations sustain collective action. And I'm making the case that the way in which they sustain collective action is going to have an important impact on their policy demands, the way in which they're engaging the state, sorts of demands they're making, and the way in which they're left able. I look at this sort of these small business organizations and these agricultural organizations, but there's a really similar story with the landless workers movement in Brazil, with slum dwellers associations in India, right? We can sort of make connections to these organizations, the sorts of models that they set up, the sorts of services they offer to their members have important implications for relationships they form with political parties, the relationships they form with the state. Even in the United States, I think there's some really important parallels. For instance, Hari Hahn has done fantastic work on the Sierra Club in the United States, right? And one of the key things that comes out of his work on the Sierra Club is the Sierra Club was informed as an association pursuing the end of climate, or so legislation to stave off climate change. The Sierra Club, most people who approach it, particularly in its early decades, were looking for other people who wanted to go on hikes with them, right? Local associations that organized hikes. This was a selected benefit. This was sort of a service that the Sierra Club offered to people. And having this way of welcoming people into the fold, having this service which gets people there, then gave the organization opportunity to sort of socialize people, to teach these people about, okay, you like going on hikes, you know, what's going to make it easier to go on more hikes is if we make sure that we don't have, you know,
strip mining.
Yeah. So this attention to the specific types of benefits that organizations are offering to their members, the way in which they've sort of mobilized their members behind narrower or broader goals, this basic intuition, I think, extends well beyond sort of the Mexican case and the particular sort of economic organizations I'm looking at. Now, in terms of the political parties, this is a story that in a lot of ways my book sort of plugs into research on transitions in party systems in Latin America. And here I have to say I'm sort of somewhat less optimistic about the potential for present party systems in Latin America to offer to be sort of vehicles for programmatic representation. At the end of the day, it's great for the organizations. I'm really interested in the ability of organizations to represent their members' interests through programmatic demands. But if those demands are going to represent, are going to end up bringing about policy change, programmatic policy change, right? So in Mexico, for instance, if Mexico is going to renegotiate NAFTA in a way that benefits small-scale corn farmers, it's not enough for a NEC and lots of a NECs to be banging on the door. Now, I think you need a political party, some state actors that want to work with a NEC and other organizations like them to design a new North American agricultural
policy. So that you have to grow up essentially the not only the organizations themselves that are representing these particular interests, but it has to be connected in terms of scale to political parties, political actors who are all sort of in one voice advocating for something like a renegotiated NAFTA.
Exactly. Yeah. So if we've ever seen any important changes in policies that benefit, economic policies that benefit these sorts of actors, these sorts of non-elite economic actors, it's because there's some left-wing political party with an important base in these sorts of organizations, right? And that political party needs to have some interest in mobilizing, right? Labor, small-scale farmers, small business owners, the indigenous, right? That party needs to have some interest in mobilizing those sorts of actors to pursue policies that are sort of broadly beneficial, to sort of look for a new development model. This is the story. I think the big success cases in Latin America over the past few decades have been the Brazilian PT under sort of the first Lula period in the early 2000s, the MAS in Bolivia also in the sort of the first decade of this century, the Frente Amplio, which is a political party in a very small country in the broad front in Uruguay. In the book, I sort of, part of what the book does is it describes how the left-wing political party in Mexico, the PRD, wasn't as successful as those three other examples in linking up with these organizations in a programmatic way. So I sort of tell the story behind that political party. And looking forward in Latin America, I'm not particularly optimistic, right? Present party systems of Latin America are much less oriented around mobilizing economic actors behind economic demands. We're seeing, just as we're seeing globally, more and more sort of populist mobilization and polarization along kind of terms of social identity that doesn't align clearly with economic goals.
And so that leads me directly into my final question, Brian. What are you working on now?
So I've taken a bit. I love this book, right? I probably shouldn't say, but this book, which just came out in summer 2022, I had been working on since 2010 or 11 or so, right? So over a decade, and I still like it, which I think could be a good sign. But I had one big dissatisfaction with it, which was that the dependent variable, the outcome, the thing that I study as sort of being the result of this process, which are these different models of representation, it didn't go as far as I would have liked. What I really want to be able to explain is policy outcomes. Why do we sometimes get policies that favor the interests of small-scale farmers and other times don't get policies that favor the interests of small-scale farmers? And my second book project takes a more political economy approach to address that question in particular. So what I'm looking at is staying in Mexico, and in this case, staying in rural Mexico, and then looking at markets for high-value agricultural exports. In particular, berries, strawberries, raspberries, blackberries, blueberries, avocados, tequila, and mezcal.
Got it.
And the idea is analyzing, it turns out these sectors are organized in really different ways. Right? The berry industry is completely dominated by transnational actors, mostly massive corporations that are based in California. They go down to Mexico to engage in contract farming, employ really cheap labor, exploit the environment, suck up all the groundwater, seed pesticides, cover the land in plastic so that we can eat raspberries year-round in the United States. The avocado sector, as sort of a contrast, is completely different, right? It continues to be mainly constituted by small, sort of medium-sized Mexican landowners who grow avocados and Mexican association that controls the export of avocados, right? So for me what was the history or what sort of the politics that made it such that the avocado sector remains a place where a small-scale farmer in Mexico can engage the lucrative economic activity on their own, whereas the berry industry didn't offer that same.
And you're also doing tequila and mezcal.
That's right, yeah. Because why not?
Because why not? It sounds like a lovely brunch here.
There's a really similar story there, right? To the tequila event. So tequila is actually a type of mezcal, right?
Right.
Tequila is the type of mezcal that is regulated really strictly under some laws that came into place going back to the 1970s, that make the production of tequila very uniform in a very industrialized process. All tequila basically tastes the same. It's all made in basically in the same way. It's made of these, well, all of the tequila we drink is made in these big factories. It's made from the exact same species of agave, this sort of cactus, the succulent. Mezcal is the term we use to describe a much wider variety of different sorts of agave-based spirits. And the mezcal industry, which has sort of developed more recently, places a lot more emphasis on terroir, on craft, on these local producers making things at a very small scale and using ancestral forms of production. So there the question is, right, does this craft mezcal industry offer economic opportunity for these families that have been engaged in the production of mezcal for many generations, right? More so than the tequila industry, which has sort of now been bought up by Seagram's and other massive...
Big and corporate.
Yeah.
And multinational. Well, I look forward to the next book. I hope you'll come and speak with me about it on the New Books podcast. And we can also eat avocados and, you know, have some mezcal while we're having the conversation. I'd like to thank Brian Palmer Rubin for joining me today to talk about Evading the Patronage Trap, Interest Representation in Mexico, published in 2022 by the University Press of Michigan, University of Michigan Press. I assume one might be able to buy this book at Boswell Bookstore in Milwaukee.
I need to look into that.
So if you're in the area, you can check out Boswell Books for purchasing Brian's book. Otherwise, I guess the University of Michigan Press website.
Yeah, and I should say the book is available. This is not good for my bottom line, but it is available. And the entire book is available as a free ebook, which you can find on the website, the webpage of the book at the University of Michigan Press as well.
And I will include that in the blurb that goes along with this podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today live and in person, Brian.
Thank you very much, Sylvia. It's been a pleasure.